It is a great privilege to introduce Father Arujo, Professor of Law and International Law at Gonzaga University. I'm pleased to report that the World Peace Through Law section has selected Father Arujo as the 2002-year recipient of the Ralph J. Bunche Award for contributions to international peace. This is the leading but not the only award of the World Peace section. The World Peace Through Law section continues in Seattle and the Northwest and perhaps on the West Coast with others, the long-term involvement of the American Bar in maintaining a sense of responsibility regarding the foreign policy of the United States, international affairs, international human rights, these things. Professor Arujo is one of the leading and distinguished teachers at Gonzaga. His arrival at Gonzaga in 1994, which he may not admit to, but I'm giving oral testimony here to the fact. That's supposed to be an evidence joke, but not working. His arrival at Gonzaga in 1994 immediately impacted and uplifted the law school. I'm speaking from my own personal experience because I was there at that time. Father Arujo was my teacher of international law and international human rights at Gonzaga. The fact of Father Arujo's impact is derived from his authentic commitment, scholarship, grasp of legal philosophy, and of technical and formal philosophy, and overall sense of responsibility for the matters of which he speaks. And Father Arujo brought these things with him, these attributes with him, when he came to Gonzaga from Columbia University, Oxford, Georgetown, Boston College, as well as, and I have a kind of kaleidoscopic or telescopic history here, but please accept this mélange, as well as from his service as legal advisor to the Vatican and concerning the work of the Vatican with the United Nations and today's topic. In my student experience in 1995-96, Father Arujo enabled me to reorganize and clarify my longstanding interest, which longstanding means going back to 1963, interest in great writers who opposed dictatorship, totalitarianism, and terrorism. This is the way we were taught to think and what to believe was important in Tenafly, New Jersey, when the school system there was great back in the 1960s, etc. Another story there. As we used to say not too many decades ago, Father Arujo, in this vein, turned me on to the writings of President Václav. I've recently learned to say Václav instead of Václav. Václav Havel, President of the Czech Republic. The Havel writings are a guidebook, and they're better written than the writings of Solzhenitsyn, which are opaque and dense and perhaps more important ultimately historically. But the Havel writings are a guidebook and show us how Churchill, Albert Camus, Solzhenitsyn, Sakharov, Mandela, Martin Luther King, and other human rights leaders accomplished their task through writing, speaking, and the power of words. It is in the tradition of these human rights leaders, as well as upon the foundations of classical moral analysis, that Father Arujo's work is being carried out. Jerry Spence has said that justice is a thing not considered or discussed in law schools in the United States today. At Gonzaga, justice is discussed. At Gonzaga is discussed and considered and dialogued about. At Gonzaga, through the work of Father Arujo and several of his core colleagues, the definition of justice is part of the definition of law, of international law, and of international human rights. Enough said about Gonzaga for those who are planning on visiting. These general concerns are consolidated into today's topic, the International Criminal Court, the option for dealing with terrorism. Please welcome Professor Robert Arujo of Gonzaga University School of Law.
Thank you so much, Paul. Former student, but always friend. Your words are too kind. I'd like to begin with a bit of history. I'm not the sort of speaker who likes to quote a lot. First of all, that can be very tedious, particularly at the end of a very warm, unusually warm day here in this beautiful city of Seattle. But we must begin somewhere. About a half century ago, Robert Jackson, Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States and a principal prosecutor at Nuremberg, in a report to President Franklin Roosevelt, written in June of 1945, said this: "The trial must not be protracted in duration by anything that is obstructive or dilatory, but we must see that it is fair and deliberative and not discredited in times to come by any mob spirit. Those who have regard for the good name of the United States as a symbol of justice under law would not have me proceed otherwise." I think there was a lot of wisdom behind what Justice Jackson said. He was a very distinguished lawyer, a distinguished public servant, a very famous individual. I am sure that there were many people from many nations at the conclusion of hostilities of the Second World War who wished to see a revenge justice. Certain members, principally German or Japanese, of high-ranking government circles and industry, had done some atrocious things, heinous crimes. They defied description in some instances. Words in many languages did not have the capability of explaining what had occurred. Jackson realized that there must be an accounting, a bringing a group of people to accountability, to responsibility. And what happened was, ladies and gentlemen, as I think we all know, the International Military Tribunal for Germany, the Nuremberg Tribunal, as it's more popularly known, and the International Military Tribunal for Japan, the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunals, were established. They did their work. Around this time, the United Nations was in its formative stages. Actually, during the hostilities, various countries began to plan for the future, that one day this terrible war, even though virtually every person on the face of the planet then had no idea of what was going on in extermination camps in Germany and other parts of Europe. The International Criminal Court has a long history. And I'm one of those lawyers who thinks that history is pertinent to the law and what it's about, because it is through history that the human race can remind itself of why we have norms that provide our ability to live in an ordered society where people count. More formally, the two international military tribunals, the one for Tokyo and the one at Nuremberg, probably set the stage for the International Criminal Court. Because you see, a part of the early business of the UN, was to establish a permanent tribunal to replace the Nuremberg Tribunal, to replace the Tokyo Tribunal. There was also a plan to have the International Court of Justice, a tribunal for resolving disputes about international law between states, that is, countries of the world. The International Court of Justice, more popularly known as the World Court, was created, was established. The plans for the ICC, or an equivalent tribunal, were put aside because probably of the tensions within the growing Cold War. But as I said, history is important, and it might be possible to actually trace some roots of the ICC back to the conclusion of the First World War, when the Allies discussed amongst themselves the possibility of trying the Kaiser for war crimes. That did not happen because the Kaiser was given asylum. History might even have some earlier roots. Interestingly enough, in some of the philosophical, theological, but also legal writings of some 16th and 17th century juridical philosophers who were commenting on the European exploration and colonization of the Western Hemisphere. And while their discussion was general, there were no particulars about a specific tribunal, recognizing that indigenous peoples who were being enslaved through military conquest were human beings, were entitled to what we now call human rights. And without justification, any individual or state who proceeded against them would be violating important normative principles. So, as you can see, my friends, the ICC has some history to it. But let us focus on the ICC that now exists. And sometime during the first or second week of July of this year, will be formally established. It will probably take a few more years, maybe a year and a half, for the court to be prepared to hear its first cases. And we can talk a little bit about that during the question and answer session later on. Now, what I think really was the contemporary catalyst for revivifying the ICC from its 1946, 47, 48 gestation was what was being discovered in Central Africa and the former Yugoslavia in the early 1990s. Interestingly, and to its credit, the Security Council, an institution often known for its disputes and inability to vote positively, agreed to establish two ad hoc tribunals to address the violations of fundamental norms of international law, particularly those focusing on crimes against humanity and war crimes and genocide. And the Security Council established the two ad hoc tribunals, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. With the creation, the establishment of those two organs, the General Assembly said, you know, a long time ago, we were talking about a permanent tribunal to do this very kind of work. And in accordance with the Charter, the Assembly asked the International Law Commission, a distinguished body of about 60 or so prominent international lawyers, teachers, jurists, to draft a statute, a proposed statute for the court. They completed their work in 1995, and having not only studied their draft, but having worked on it in the context of my service to the Holy See and its diplomatic service, and my attendance at virtually all of the meetings involving the ICC conducted by the UN, save for the first one, I have seen the important contribution of their work. I tend to think, ladies and gentlemen, that if the ILC, the International Law Commission's draft, had pretty much survived intact, a lot of the political disputes regarding the ICC today might have been avoided. The ILC drafted a fine text. It was direct. It was simple. And their text essentially supplied the basis for the two ad hoc tribunals, the one for Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, to begin its operation and actually bring individuals accused of horrible acts to justice. Now, the ILC, as I said, finished its work in 1995. The General Assembly then, through a vote of the body, said we're going to conduct a preparatory committee. And this is the normal way in which the United Nations family begins to address the development of international law. Not the only way, but a principal way because we know it will set the stage for a diplomatic conference. We have to remind ourselves that the United Nations, in and of itself, is not a governmental body. It is not a legislative assembly. Having said that, it can set the stage for the proper vehicles to get together to legislate, to draft a treaty. So toward the end of 1996, the first preparatory committee, was held in New York City. And their task was to begin reviewing the International Law Commission's draft proposal for an international criminal court. The manner in which the United Nations and its preparatory committees and then preparatory commissions operates is to usually bring in experts, and in this case, international law experts, for periods ranging from 2 to 3 weeks to do work, to try and advance a proposal, in this case, the International Law Commission's text. Now, many issues had to be addressed. What would the crimes be? And very briefly, the crimes now covered by the ILC text are genocide. The source of that largely comes out of the 1948 Convention on Genocide, which came out of the successful prosecutions that were largely conducted at the Nuremberg Tribunal. Basically, one person, one state, does not execute en masse groups of people based on ethnicity, religion, race. If you do, you commit genocide. Importantly, there was little disagreement on that being a crime and that being in the statute. To their credit, most of the nations of the world, members of the United Nations, were in agreement on that important principle. More difficult was elaborating crimes against humanity and war crimes. Now, what the ILC did was to look at some existing treaties, conventions, the 1949 Geneva Conventions, looking at what they had said about war crimes, some of the old Hague Conventions from the late 19th century and early 20th century, a good basis. Looking at some of the Nuremberg prosecutions and some other human rights instruments as sources for crimes against humanity, a good basis to begin our work. But there were other issues that were beginning to create divisions. Some of them involved state sovereignty. In the minds of some folks, that can be a problematic word, term, because it conjures up an insulation of a government from responsibility. And I have no disagreement with that. But another important facet of sovereignty is the rights of people to self-determination. And we have to be careful about criticizing sovereignty without identifying which one we are talking about, because it is self-determination, which I think is inextricably related to human rights. A state sovereignty immune from the rule of law, that's the one that's the problem. And that's what Nazi Germany tried to get away with, and other states have tried to get away with throughout human history. So the sovereignty issue was a concern. There were practical concerns about would there or there not be reservations to the treaty? Would there be a further elaboration of the elements of the crimes? But very early on in the preparatory committee work, probably as early as February of 1997, or later that spring when we had the third preparatory committee meeting, a number of countries began to raise questions about including other crimes, such as the crime of terrorism and international drug trafficking. I think it's fair to say that most of the House, meaning most of the lawyers on the Sixth Committee working on the draft proposal prepared by the International Law Commission, not only understood but were sympathetic with these suggestions for including these other crimes. The problem was the need to do something more quickly to address principal crimes. I'm going to focus on the issue of terrorism since that's the topic for this evening, the ICC as a vehicle, as a mechanism in dealing with terrorism, the so-called option for terrorism. Countries as diverse as those from the Caribbean world, the Western world, the Middle East, and the Orient said, how about including terrorism? Again, little disagreement with the concept. The problem was, as we began to see in the debates, who was a terrorist? Now, you see, we currently have about 10 to a dozen international agreements, treaties, juridical instruments carrying with them legal obligations for parties, states who are parties to these treaties, to address terrorism. Interestingly, none of them define terrorism or who is a terrorist. The practical issue here is my terrorist might be your freedom fighter. Your terrorist might be my freedom fighter. Not personally, but that's how states address this. And if that indeed were the case, that would present great difficulties for trying to make progress and getting a statute that could then be submitted to states for potential ratification. What changed all of this was what occurred on that important date in U.S. history, the 11th of September. I want to add at this point that at the Rome Diplomatic Conference that Paul mentioned, and at which I was for the full 5 weeks, plus a week before and a bit after, I can assure you it was no Roman holiday. It was a lot of work. We started drafting early in the morning, drafting through the day, debating, discussing, and more work into the evening, and on occasion, into the next morning. The issue of terrorism came up again. Countries like Turkey, Caribbean states, said, let's include it. This is important. About a week after the attack on the World Trade Center, a Turkish diplomat was recognized and raised the issue once again and said, you see, we told you, terrorism is something we must address. In a very eloquent and, I think, insightful intervention, the term we use for speeches given at the United Nations, the Turkish delegate not only said, I told you so, in nice, careful diplomatic language, but also provided a course of how terrorism could be included in the ICC statute without the need of having to wait for the first review conference, which will probably occur, by my estimation, in about 9 years, the first opportunity to formally amend the ICC statute. The justification for including terrorism that he offered was in the yet undefined crime of aggression. Aggression is one of those tough crimes to pin down, like terrorism. Everybody agrees it's bad. The problem is in the meaning, the definition of the term. Once again, what I think is the war of aggression might be your war of freedom and independence, and vice versa. We have one more meeting of the Preparatory Commission that will occur in early July. Our task is to try and make some progress on the crime of aggression. I know the discussion on whether or not we can include terrorism will come up again. Being a prudential individual, I think progress will have to be made on other spheres, in other areas, and the terrorism question, at least formally being introduced as a specific crime under the statute, will probably have to wait. Now, having said that, does that mean that the international legal community is presently paralyzed? And I'm, again, thinking in the context of the International Criminal Court, which will shortly go into existence. I'm going to offer a cautious suggestion that I think it would be possible, once the court goes into operation, to address terrorism. But we also have to keep in mind, my friends, that a principal part of the ICC statute is that states, that countries, under international law, can, under their own law, and if that law incorporates international law, as is the case here in the United States, that terrorism, or at least some acts that would be defined as terrorism, or could be defined as terrorism through interpretation, could be currently prosecuted. I don't want to get too ahead of myself at this stage, but at this point, I would like to make that suggestion. Now, what would be the basis? As I mentioned a few moments ago, we currently have about not quite a dozen treaties addressing terrorism involving the hijacking and the taking of hostages on commercial airlines. We have similar international conventions, juridical instruments, sources of law dealing with maritime shipping. There is a convention to which many states are parties concerning the financing of international terrorism, the prohibition, not encouraging the financing, but rather the prohibition of the financing. And lastly, an important convention dealing with international trafficking of explosives used for terrorist purposes. Many states, many countries, including the United States, have their own body of what we call domestic law, national law, addressing many of these activities. But here again, ladies and gentlemen, is the question. Is it possible that acts of terrorism, particularly some of those that we saw conducted on the 11th of September of this past year, can they be prosecuted under the International Criminal Court statute? And my answer is, the cautious lawyer in me says, quite possibly. To the layperson, I believe so. There are components of crimes against humanity and war crimes that would enable a national prosecutor or the prosecutor at the new ICC to prosecute these crimes. What are these crimes? I think the easier route, I'm an East Coast native, so I say route. I guess we say route, huh? The easier route would be through crimes against humanity, including the crime against humanity of murder, the crime against humanity of torture, and the crime against humanity of unlawful imprisonment, and depending on the translation, unlawful detention. And if we think back, ladies and gentlemen, to the events of the 11th of September, people were murdered, people were tortured, and people were surely unlawfully detained or imprisoned. War crimes gives us a few more options, but more difficult in this context to prosecute. And my justification for saying that is any person, regardless of his or her connection or lack thereof, with any governmental organization, corporate body, any person can be tried for a crime against humanity. With war crimes, there is some further need to make some sort of connection with an organized body, typically an organized military body. But what are the crimes against, excuse me, the war crimes that would set the basis for these prosecutions? War crimes of willful killing. Now, again, the lawyer in me says, what's the distinction between murder and willful killing? Now, we're not talking about armed combat on a battlefield, not that kind of willful killing. I say this not to tease you, to tease the non-lawyers, or the lawyers, for that matter, assembled here, but to let you know, for the past 6 years, that the United Nations, good people, intelligent people, very superb international law lawyers have been saying, what's the difference between murder and willful killing. Nonetheless, what we would normally think of as murder, as a war crime, is called willful killing. Again, a repetition of torture. There's the war crime of willful causing of great suffering, and I suspect it would not be difficult to demonstrate how that was done on the 11th of September. The taking of hostages, normally civilian hostages, although under some circumstances a person in the military could be taken hostage in violation of war crimes. And lastly, the destruction of civilian property. So as you can see through this brief survey, these crimes, which exist in a lot of national legislation, but also under the statute of the International Criminal Court, provide a legal avenue for a good, competent prosecutor to make his or her case, to try a terrorist who commits murder, who commits the unlawful destruction of civilian property, who unlawfully imprisons or detains others, who tortures others, who willfully causes great suffering. Now, looking at the ICC text, the statute, the treaty, who is responsible, meaning who can be prosecuted? The statute, like virtually any criminal law, says the person, the natural person, the live flesh and blood who does these terrible things is responsible, meaning this person can be indicted and tried for these crimes. A pretty conventional principle that runs throughout national law and subdivision law, such as here in the United States, both federal law and state law. When we look at certain of the war crimes, that's where we have to pay more attention to the command structure. Again, there is individual responsibility, but what intensifies the measure, the degree, the magnitude of the atrocity sometimes is it's commanded from a very high place and directed towards subordinates who, through their own participation, would be individually responsible. So for some of these crimes, we also want to take account of, even though this individual did not actually carry out the crime, did this person order it? Did this person have the opportunity to supervise the individuals who did this, but did nothing within his or her competence, authority, to stop this from happening? Again, I don't see any major problems with who is responsible under the ICC statute. Those individuals certainly directly involved with the execution of these crimes, and in some instances, those involved with their planning would be responsible. I think a part of the ICC statute that often goes unreported in the public press, meaning the Seattle papers, CNN, the major networks, independent television, news magazines throughout the world, tend to forget to discuss, perhaps because the reporters don't know about this, the concept of complementarity that the statute addresses. Now, what's that all about, complementarity? A multisyllabic word that suggests lawyers are trying to confuse people. Actually, it's a simple concept. And it was an essential and important part of getting support for the ICC statute. When states made good intervention speeches on why they had concerns about the statute and its power, the court's power, and what the court could do under the statute. And everyone agreed that it is the country, it is the state where the crime occurs, or has nationals who are victims of crimes, that they have the principal, the first authority to prosecute. And if that would take place and be conducted with honesty, due process of law, but also a proper zeal in good prosecution, there might not be a need for an ICC. The problem is, in so many instances, when the state that is presumably responsible for the prosecution is directly or indirectly responsible for the actions, would it really prosecute its own? Hence the need for some sort of international criminal tribunal. So the concept of complementarity was viewed not as a compromise, but as a vehicle for assuaging the legitimate fears of some countries that we were not creating a super court, in one sense, but allowing national courts to do their proper job. And if they could not or would not, then complementarity would enable the ICC to take over. Now, as is the case with so much law, there's always a dimension, an element, a component of politics. And I think it is this political dimension of the court that causes concerns, fears for many states on why they have not ratified the statute. The political concern focuses on how will this court function. Any court surely has some political dimension to it. When you think about it, here in the United States, our judges are either appointed by governors or the president, usually with the advice and consent of some legislative body, or are elected directly by the people. That's a political process. Judges in most national legal systems are appointed by a political process. The judges of the International Criminal Court will be appointed through a political process of the Assembly of States Parties, which is the term given to the countries who have ratified the statute. These are the countries which will appoint the judges. So that's a political process. I think it's important that the individuals who are appointed, nominated, and then elected by the Assembly of States Parties, hence appointed, be prominent jurists, familiar with international law as objective jurists, not as subjective jurists. Those who have compassion for the victim, but also understand the importance of due process of law. I know some of you were with me a few years ago at a Washington State Bar Association continuing legal education program involving international law and war crimes and crimes against humanity. And the distinguished Professor Ben Ferencz, a dear friend of mine, was one of the speakers, the principal speaker, I think, with all due respect to the others, including me, who was also a speaker at that same event. Ben was a young man, maybe even a kid, who had just graduated from Harvard Law School. Ben was drafted into the Army, and for a very short while he served as an enlisted man. General Telford Taylor, another prosecutor at Nuremberg, got wind that Ben Ferencz was around. And he called him in one day and he said, "Son," this is my understanding of the story Ben tells, "you're an enlisted man today. How'd you like to be a colonel tomorrow?" He said, "Let me think it over." And he thought it over and he said, "Sounds like a good deal, General. What do I have to do?" He said, "You got to be a prosecutor." And Ben prosecuted the so-called mobile death squads who went around Europe. They didn't operate out of a death camp, but rather they brought the death camp to the victims. He prosecuted those individuals. Ben is of a Jewish background, so the significance, the personal significance of being involved with this took on a very important dimension for him. But he said, "I'm a lawyer. I have to be fair. I have to be firm, and I'm going to get the guilty." But he also realized that some individuals were wrongly accused. And due process of law, the rule of law, requires that an individual who did not commit a crime, regardless of its degree of atrocity, should not be punished, should not be convicted. And he said, to the credit of the Nuremberg Tribunal and its prosecutions, individuals were acquitted of crimes. This would be important for the success and, I think, the credibility of the ICC to assuage the fears of many states, not just the remaining superpower, but many states who are still not quite sure about the court. If the court respects due process of law, the rule of law, is firm in its prosecutions, but also understanding of the wisdom of why people can be acquitted, its future for success will be strengthened. What will not bode well for the ICC is if indeed it is used as a weapon by a prosecutor influenced by a certain state or other states to prosecute individuals, not because of what they've done, but because they happen to represent a state who at that moment is not enjoying a great measure of popularity. That will be most harmful to the court and its success. I mentioned to Paul and Joanne that I would speak for about 45 or 50 minutes, and I'm coming up to that now, so I'd like to reach my conclusions and then we could have some discussion. Well, what is my conclusion? There are many skeptics who are concerned about the ICC. And having been a part of the deliberations for over 6 years now, I can appreciate some of the skepticism, some of the concern. What I think will remove, eliminate the legitimate concern of the skeptic will be that it is the rogue element who are in vast number throughout the world who are the proper targets of investigation and prosecution. If we can see and use as a model of this the two ad hoc tribunals and the credibility that those two tribunals, notwithstanding the fact that they were creations or creatures of the Security Council, have done much to advance the rule of law and its due process. If the ICC can duplicate that, we will live in a much safer world. Safer, not just for some, but I think for all humanity, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am. You mean the American administration, the U.S. Yeah. You didn't ask this particularly, but I'm sure at some point your question focuses on the so-called unsigning of the statute. Yeah. Direct answer is, this really hasn't been done before. It's unusual. Having said that, is it unlawful? There really isn't much law on this point. We have the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties that talks about what are the obligations of signature and then what happens when you ratify a treaty, in this case, the statute. There are some general customary law principles, not written down, but most international law lawyers would generally agree upon, that say essentially the same thing. In criticism of any state that tries to unsign a convention, a treaty, that it has placed its signature on, we want to be very clear on what are the obligations of that and can that be undone. And I use the analogy of a country which ratifies a statute or a treaty. Virtually every treaty, including the statute for the International Criminal Court, allows a country that has become a party to it to denounce the treaty. Now, that may sound like a harsh word. That's the technical term in international law for withdrawing from a treaty, to denounce it. Now, there's a particular process for doing that. In the case of the ICC statute, a country that chooses to withdraw from its obligations must give notice. It gives notice to some particular individual in office. I forget who, but the statute specifies that. And then there is a waiting period of 1 year. And this is pretty common in most treaties, ma'am, that a country can withdraw formally and no longer be obligated to its former obligations. If a country can withdraw from a treaty and denounce it, could it conceivably, conceptually, do the same thing with a signature? Now, it's never really been done before. The obligation of signing a treaty is you do not have the affirmative duty to follow what's in the treaty. You have the duty not to undermine what's in the treaty, not to in some way subvert the substantive component of the treaty. And I've talked to a number of international lawyers about this, and we all come up with the same conclusion. This really hasn't been done before, at least not with the profile now. Having said that, if a state can withdraw from a treaty, can it withdraw from its signature? Again, there's not any precedence like there is for treaties, but that's the best answer. Unusual. As a practical matter, what normally happens when a country has signed a treaty and isn't going to ratify it, they normally don't say anything about it. They just let the signature stay. If you think about it, ma'am, there were many important treaties of this type back in the 19th century and early 20th century. The first Geneva Conventions and Hague Conventions involving some of these human rights issues and the proper versus the improper conduct of war and the protection of civilians, the protection of armed personnel. And many countries signed those treaties. They never ratified them. In some instances, the treaties went into force, in others they didn't, meaning they were now, you know, in existence. And the countries who simply signed them found it pretty easy to go off to war and do some pretty terrible things. So that's kind of a long answer to a pressing question that I know a lot of people have. Is there precedence for this? Nope. Is it absolutely against international law? I tend to think not. If you can denounce a treaty after you ratify it, I suppose you can be able to do something that carries less of a legal obligation. Sir, and then, sir.
What's the difference between the ICC and the World Court?
Okay. Both probably had their same inception, the beginning of the United Nations. The World Court, as it's popularly called, its formal title is the International Court of Justice, a creature of the United Nations and a creature of its own statute, just like the ICC is a creature of its statute. The purpose for the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, is to resolve disputes between states, and only states can be parties to a dispute before the court. To put that in the language that most of us can understand, if two countries have a disagreement over their respective legal obligations, be it from a treaty, which is written, or customary law, which is not written, they have the right to essentially sue one another for a clarification on their legal obligations. And the country who essentially is in the position of the plaintiff, technically called the applicant, it can actually seek compensation, remuneration, against the bad guy, if you will. So the ICJ has a fair amount of authority, but it principally focuses on resolving disputes between countries. Not
a civil court.
Actually a civil court with a very particular responsibility. It is not a court of general jurisdiction like most of our civil courts here in the United States or for that matter throughout the world are. It is a court of very particular competence, as is the ICC. We have to keep in mind, again, the part of history that essentially the role of the ICJ was to resolve the civil disagreements with the possibility of remuneration for disagreements of legal obligations under international law. The earlier proposed ICC, they didn't call it that, but that, you know, that's what it's become, was to try persons, not states, but persons, be they the president, the prime minister, the premier, or some common soldier, or some plain citizen who was accused of committing an international crime. So very different jurisdictions. It took relatively a relatively short time to establish the ICJ. It has taken over 50 years to establish the ICC. In the eyes of some, and I'll, final point on answering your question is that sometimes in the law, as those of us who are lawyers know, it takes a long time to get a result. There was a gentleman over here first. Yeah. I'm going to be cautious about saying what I share and what I don't because I do formally represent a sovereign. Having said that, I can comment on what was publicly said because a lot of NGOs were present at these meetings. I know there's a lot of criticism right now in our country, in the United States, about the ICC, particularly from the current administration. I think it's very important, ladies and gentlemen, to remember that the United States delegation made some very important substantive contributions to the ICC and its statute. And that's something to be very proud of. Notwithstanding the current position, much of the good in the statute came out of the pens or the word processors of our fellow countrymen and women. And then Ambassador David Sheffer, a Clinton appointee, was at many of the preparatory committee meetings and virtually, I think, every day at the Rome Diplomatic Conference, unless he was called back to Washington, D.C., on which occasion he was. The man spoke with eloquence, but he also spoke and raised very great concerns of a different administration, and I think those concerns haven't changed. At the last minute, there were, I think, three countries on the very last day that could sign because the 31st of December of 2000 was the last day for signature. That doesn't prevent any state who never signed it from acceding to the statute and becoming a party, but there was some symbolism to that. Iran, Israel, and the United States signed the statute on the last day. I think they all did it for interesting reasons, as they say in the world of diplomacy. Is there anything to prevent the United States or any other state that has or has not or withdrawn its signature to become a party? No. Even those countries who haven't signed the statute can still accede to it and become a full party to it. So there's a lot to your very important question. I hope I've been able to capture some of it. But back in those five tough, hard weeks of work, Ambassador Sheffer, for whom I have a great deal of personal respect, a person of great integrity, of eloquence, was very clear on some of the U.S.'s reservations then, and he was from a different administration. You, sir, and then the woman in the orange shirt.
Father, what about enforcement? How is the ICC going to enforce its decision-making, its decisions, judgments?
There's an even earlier problem about enforcement before we even get to once the decision is issued. And actually, I think that's easier because in most instances, the person who has been indicted and who has been subjected to the trial has been in custody. The problem of enforcing the law is when the would-be defendant is not in custody and there is no international police force. Under the statute, I don't think it would be possible to create one. The mechanism used for bringing persons to justice is what is called state responsibility. And this is an important, probably one of the most important obligations of being a party to the statute. That if you are a party to the statute, you have the obligation to cooperate with the court. Meaning, in practical terms, if the bad guy is in your territory, on your airplane, or on your ship, where you are able, meaning the state is able, to claim territorial jurisdiction, then it is that state's responsibility to turn this person over, to apprehend this individual who is the subject of the investigation and who has probably been indicted by this time. If you think back to some of the experiences of the two ad hoc tribunals, that was, I think, their biggest problem. It was interestingly Milosevic's own government who turned him in, But if you think about some of his principal lieutenants who earlier on were indicted but were not brought into custody because nobody really had the jurisdiction. Even some of the I-4 troops, I-4 commanders from Europe and the United States said, hey, we know this guy is here. No law to do that. So the real enforcement problem, I think, is the detention of the individual. Once that person is brought before the court, the enforcement issues become considerably less and I think disappear. The real enforcement problem is, since there is no what we would call the police force. You know, if we go out here and drive 3,000 miles down 4th Avenue, we're probably going to be stopped by the local police or the Washington State Patrol. They will have us in custody. They have the authority to do that. The problem with not only the ICC, but the two ad hoc tribunals is sometimes it's going to be difficult to get to bring the person who's been indicted to justice. That's why this dimension of state cooperation is really the best substitute we were able to come up with. Okay. Yes, ma'am. Oh, I think there'd probably, you know, I want to make one point and then get to answering your question. The point is this: the fact that some state has, like the United States, has technically said they've unsigned the treaty, unsigned the statute. What if they actually go out and help? And that's not beyond the realm of possibility, because the United States and other countries in the past have said, we're never going to be a party to this treaty, and they observe it, and they cooperate. So we've got to keep that in mind. Coming back directly or more directly to your question, I think at this stage the role of NGOs, insofar as they're American citizens, you know, can do what any American citizen or any interest group can do, and that is to talk with, to use the more common term, lobby members of Congress and the administration. In my former life, meaning before I entered the Jesuit order and became a priest, I worked for 5 years as a lawyer for the United States in a regulatory agency. I know what it's like to be lobbied. And then for the next 6 years of my professional career, I worked as a lawyer and in-house counsel for an oil company. I know what it's like to lobby. So in the first case, I was the lobbied, and in the second case, I was the lobbyer. And I think what's instrumental is both members of the administration and members of Congress, particularly on the two foreign relations committees, are probably the people who would be the best individuals and responsible persons to approach through citizen work, not on just on this issue, but on any issue. Thank you very much.